Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. The podcast 99% Invisible had its beginnings right here at KALW. In fact, creator and host Roman Mars used to work in this very studio I'm recording in now. We should put a plaque about it in here or something. Anyways, in the latest episode of 99% Invisible, they investigate one of Oakland's most draconian laws, which just so happens to be about one of my favorite pastimes. Here's the full-length episode, intended for amusement only.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars.
Item 4 is actions on special orders of the day that typically proceeds with your council member announcement.
What you're hearing is an Oakland, California City Council meeting that took place in July of 2014. Announcements or there's a whole bunch of different issues on the agenda. Everything from allegations of funds being misused.
We know that there was a lot of manipulation of funds. Okay? And there's been a big ripoff with those funds.
To announcements of neighborhood parties.
Basketball, pickup games, field games, face painting, Zumba dancing.
And producer Mickey Capra sat through the entire meeting like a good reporter does.
To hear them say this.
Move the item, Madam President.
Moved by Vice Mayor Reed.
Second.
Seconded by Ms. McElhaney, and by consensus will adopt the items in the consent calendar.
So they never actually say it directly, but by adopting the items in the consent calendar, what happened there is that the city of Oakland finally legalized, for the first time since the 1930s, pinball machines.
I'm Michael Sheese. I'm the founder and executive director of the Pacific Pinball Museum.
The Pacific Pinball Museum, which is a collection of really cool, mostly older machines that you can still play, is in Oakland's neighboring city, Alameda. Until recently, coin-operated pinball machines were also illegal in Alameda.
And it's the reason that we started out as a admission-based establishment and everything was on free play.
Most of the museum's pinball machines look a lot like the ones you've seen before in your local bar, but there are a few really old ones that look completely different. And pinball's design history can help explain why it was illegal for so long and why, after nearly 80 years of being a slightly sketchy leather jacket-wearing ne'er-do-well, pinball can now go legit and claim its place with Pac-Man as good, clean family fun.
Pinball evolved out of a game that was also played in a tilted cabinet, but was a bit more like billiards. You'd shoot the ball onto the field with a pool stick.
In the 1860s, the pool cue turned into a spring-loaded plunger that you'd pull and release to launch the ball. They were simple wooden boards with glass tops. No electricity, no flashy art or colors. And the game was made small to fit on top of a counter at a bar or drugstore.
The mechanics of the game were simpler, too. You basically did one action, pull the plunger.
The ball would shoot up the right side of the board and onto the play field, where there were
little pockets that would catch the ball. And then they were usually stamped with a point value.
And there were pins, which looked like tiny nails that obstructed your way into the pockets.
That's where pinball came from, was the nails or the pins that were driven into the board.
And the first games weren't coin-operated. Bars would buy one.
And they would rent it out to people that wanted to play it and gamble with it. It was kind of like renting out the card table.
By the 1930s, pinball games were coin-operated. And you'd find these little countertop games all over the place, in bars and drugstores.
You know, you'd buy an egg cream to drink and some horrible-tasting elixir at the local drugstore, and you'd use your change to play some pinball. And maybe you'd win a pack of gum or a cigar, and you'd have fun doing it.
Then it moved to just straight-up gambling.
Where, instead of being awarded a prize, you were given cash.
And it's around this point that pinball became electric. Lights and buzzers started showing up, along with other stuff like bumpers that you could bounce off of to get more points.
Points that needed to be tallied up on a scoreboard, which led to what is now referred to as the back glass. That's the part of the pinball machine that faces you as you play.
And the art on the back glass became one of the most iconic things about the pinball machine.
On the newer games, a lot of the art is licensed from movies, like the 1991 hit blockbuster The Addams Family. But if you go into the Pinball Museum in Alameda, almost all the old games from the 30s and 40s were done by one of two artists.
It's George Melanton and Roy Parker.
The art was meant to appeal to men and boys, so a lot of it features pictures of pretty ladies.
The back glass of a game called Marble Queen depicts a group of women in swimsuits and high heels gathered around in a circle playing marbles. They're surrounded by a big tall fence, almost like they're in a clubhouse.
And you see the guys that are, you know, peeking through the fence, and it's pretty funny.
The ultimate fantasy of a boy from the 1930s was women in their bathing suits playing marbles.
The lights and buzzers and women in bathing suits just made you want to put more and more money into the machines. Sometimes people were just playing to win a free game. Other times there was a bigger payout, but it all added up.
These things made a ton of money. I can't emphasize enough of that because the mafia got involved. It was all cash.
With so much money disappearing into pinball machines, the authorities started cracking down.
It really got heated in the 40s. More and more laws were being enacted to make pinball gambling harder.
Manufacturers would try to get around this by labeling the machines.
It says right here, for amusement only, no prizes, no wagering. I mean, they put that right on the machine. And everybody knew that, well, that's exactly what it was for.
By the end of the 1940s, pinball was banned in most major cities, including Chicago and Los Angeles.
But perhaps nowhere was the pinball crackdown so extreme as in New York City, where in 1942, Mayor LaGuardia ordered the NYPD to round up all of the machines. Then, in a press event, the mayor personally shattered some of the machines with a sledgehammer and had them dumped into the Hudson River.
LaGuardia later reported that 2,000 new police billy clubs would be made from the wooden legs of old pinball machines, perfect for knocking the heads of pinball-playing hooligans.
Mayor LaGuardia did not succeed in ridding the world of pinball entirely, though. It was still legal in some cities, and even in New York, it didn't totally disappear. It just moved into seedy underground establishments.
Meanwhile, the game designers were still developing new features, the most important of which were the flippers that first appeared in 1947 that allowed you to swap the ball around the playfield by pressing two buttons on either side of the machine. In other words, the flippers gave you some control over the outcome of the game.
Remember, when pinball machines were first banned, the games were considered a game of chance. You'd basically put your quarter in, pull back the plunger, and hope for the best.
When the flipper was added to the pinball machine, it should have changed the game's legal status. It wasn't a game of chance anymore. You could finally control the ball. If only they could find some way to prove it.
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Roger Sharp.
I guess at one point I was considered to be, if not the best player in the world, one of the best players in the world.
Nearly 40 years after the introduction of the flipper, in April of 1976, Roger Sharp was called upon to prove that pinball was a game of skill before a meeting of the New York City Council.
On the day of the hearing, tensions were high.
It was packed. A lot of camera crews.
The New York State Coin-Operated Amusement Game Association had arranged for the hearing, and they'd hauled two pinball machines into the meeting room. One that Sharp was to play, and another that would serve as a backup in case the first one suddenly died.
And I started going over to the game that had been designated.
The council had been pretty antagonistic to Sharp. They thought he would cheat. And right before he was supposed to play, a council member stopped him.
He said, no, not that game. That game over there. I think that the head of the city council thought that that game was somehow rigged. Let's go with the game that's been turned off, that nobody's paid any attention to, that's over there in the corner.
The council session took a 20-minute recess so that the camera crews could change the lighting from the original machine to the new machine.
And then Roger Sharp steps up and starts playing.
Back then, I was able to really show off, so it was very nice to be able to call my shots and just do whatever I wanted to do, making backhands and shots from right to left and left to right.
And then, for the grand finale, Sharp wanted to prove that even the first shot, the one that involves just pulling back the plunger and letting go, that even that shot can be perfected with skill. So he turns to the council members and says,
if I do this right, it's going to land right down the center. Pull back the plunger, it went up, and the ball went straight down the center. And the guy who was at the city council kind of threw up his hand, that's enough. And I was ready to keep on playing. I was having fun. City Council voted 6-0 to pass the legislation.
Sharp has said in the past that he got lucky with this shot. But now he says that he was being modest, that his plunge was not luck.
To do what I did, that was skill. to have done it the way that I did it was pure naivete.
Within a year, pinball was legal again in most places across the country.
But not in Oakland and Alameda, where, as we heard in the beginning of the show, pinball just became legal in 2014.
Even with the rise of video games, the pinball industry continued to experience waves of success until the 1990s. But over time, people lost interest.
The last big corporation to manufacture pinball machines lost millions of dollars on its pinball division and decided to shut down in favor of a more profitable operation, making slot machines for casinos.
After decades of fighting to prove that pinball could be a game of skill, it turned out that the most lucrative bet for game makers was on games of chance, gambling machines.
You know Bally's Casino? They used to be in the pinball business, and they took their name from their first hit pinball machine manufactured in 1932 called Ballyhoo.
Welcome to the 21st century.
In 1999, pinball tried to make a comeback with a game that integrated a video screen on the back glass with a mechanical playfield.
Welcome to Pinball 2000. Welcome to the new image in pinball. Welcome to the 21st century.
That was a promo video for Pinball 2000. Despite the reverb and the menacing ticking clock and the mountains of hyperbole heaped upon the promotion of the game, it never really caught on.
Which is probably because if pinball still has any appeal, it's actually the vintage analog nostalgia feelings it brings up in people. We like it because it's not the future. It's the past.
Back at the Pacific Pinball Museum, Mike Schies thinks pinball is making a bit of a comeback, and it's because people are longing to get away from screens and from games that they play at home alone.
So with pinball, you can kind of gather around and watch your friends suck. And that's the other thing that's really cool, is that anybody can suck at pinball. I mean, it's a great equalizer. You don't have to be smart. You don't have to be physically an athlete.
I think what he means is that anybody can suck and anybody can be great. It's a nerd's game, a rebel's game, an underdog's game. One of the best pinball players in the U.S. right now is a young guy with autism who can memorize the geometric patterns that the ball makes on the playfield.
And then, of course, there's that deaf, dumb, and blind kid I heard about once. Never saw him play, but I heard he was really good.
Ever since I was a young boy, I played the silver ball. From Soho down to Brighton, I must have played them all. But I ain't seen nothing like him in any amusement hall. That deaf, dumb, and blind kid sure plays a mean pinball.
99% Invisible was produced this week by Mickey Capper and Katie Mingle, with Sam Greenspan, Avery Truffleman, and me, Roman Mars. Mickey did another piece about pinball and its roots in Chicago for a program I love called Curious City. It's not really like just a show, it's this news gathering experiment based at WBEZ where people submit questions about Chicago and Curious City investigates and reports. It's genius. We'll have a link on our website. We are a project of 91.7 local public radio KALW in San Francisco and produced out of the offices of ArcSign, an architecture firm in beautiful downtown, always law-abiding Oakland, California.
You're listening to The Spot on KALW. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. So, Roman just stated his love for the podcast and radio project, Curious City. And instead of taking the easy route and playing for you Mickey Capper's other pinball story, I'd like to highlight another Curious City episode that hits just a little closer to home. I'm a Bay Area native, and it was only last year when I first learned about the area's involvement with the U.S. Nike missile program. From the 1950s to 1970s, the highest peaks surrounding the San Francisco Bay were home to ground-to-air missiles, ready to go at a moment's notice in over 23 separate sites. Fort Funston, Wildcat Peak in Berkeley, and even the highest point of Angel Island, which is where I literally stumbled across the program's history. Since it was decommissioned, you can visit many of the site locations, as they're now state parks. Across the U.S., all in all, there were over 300 Nike missile sites built between 1953 and 1974, including in the Midwest.
You are listening to the Curious City podcast from WBEZ Chicago. You ask the questions, we answer them together.
We all know the atomic bomb is very dangerous. Since it may be used against us, we must get ready for it. Our civil defense workers and our men in uniform will do everything they can to warn us before enemy planes can bring a bomb near us. You may be in your schoolyard playing when the signal comes. That signal means to stop whatever you are doing and get to the nearest safe place fast. First, you duck, and then you cover. And very tightly, you cover the back of your neck and your face.
Duck and cover. Duck and cover.
Hey, curious citizens, I'm Logan Jaffe, the intern. Ian Larkin wondered about the missile defenses that peppered Chicago and the suburbs in the 1950s and 60s.
It absolutely blew me away that there were anti-aircraft missiles stationed in or near Winnetka / Chicago. And so it did get me curious as to what the story was behind that.
Ian asked us to bring that Cold War history back to life. So here's Jennifer Brandel with a little time warp.
Ian Larkin has a lot of questions about the Nike missiles that used to guard Chicago.
Why they were there, what they were trying to protect, what the purpose of the program was, how long it ran, when did they come out, etc.
Okay, here goes. I'm going to take on Ian's question in two styles. First, let's do the history buff's take. If you have a fuzzy memory or didn't live through it, the Cold War was not just the backdrop of James Bond movies. It was a real quest for ideological dominance between the Soviet Union and the United States. It was communism versus capitalism. That was the theme of the era, and also the title of this old archival film from the National Education Program.
It is called a Cold War because armed forces, although used as a threat, are rarely unleashed, and blood is not spilled in the massive battles that we think of as war.
The U.S. and the Soviet Union never attacked one another directly, but they were prepared to do that. In the early 1950s, the threat of Soviet attack inspired several new U.S. weapons, including Nike missiles. It also inspired lots of American propaganda designed to scare the Soviets and comfort Americans.
America forges an ever tighter ring of air defense. With radar scanners probing the skies 24 hours a day, anti-aircraft men scramble to man the batteries of guided missiles that guard all important cities, in this case, Chicago. Nike, America's most powerful aircraft destroyer, is ready for action in a matter of minutes. Nike, whose true performance is a carefully guarded secret, tracks down its target at supersonic speeds, hurling its half-ton warhead squarely into enemy bomber.
Nike missiles were deployed at more than 300 sites all over the U.S. in case Soviet planes crossed the Arctic Circle and bombed us from the north. The Chicago area had 22 missile installations spanning from Libertyville to the north, to Naperville in the west, to Homewood in the south, and Porter, Indiana in the east. Collectively, they formed a protective, quote, ring of supersonic steel.
The Nike rocket itself was supersonic. That is, that it went faster than the speed of sound, and made of steel, hence the phrase, rings of supersonic steel.
That's Mark Burhau. He's a chemist with the USDA, and he's a Nike missile historian. He co-wrote a book detailing the history of America's Nike sites and weapons. Burhau says the missile program had a couple of phases, starting in the 50s.
There was the Nike Ajax and the Nike Hercules. So the Nike Ajax was developed first. It was a liquid-fueled missile, and its range was about 30 miles.
The Nike Ajax could hit a single plane, and the Hercules could travel farther, and it had a nuclear warhead, so it could take out a whole squadron of planes at once, in theory. Impressive, maybe, but the Nike couldn't keep up with technology. By the late 1950s, the Soviets developed the Intercontinental Ballistic Missile, or ICBM. ICBMs could hit targets thousands of miles away. Here's Mark Burhau.
There's two things about them. One is they have a very wide range. And two, they're like a bullet. They go up in the air and they come down. You know, it's like trying to hit a rock with a rock.
The Nike missiles weren't designed to shoot down other missiles, and they were no match for ICBMs anyway. But Chicago didn't lose the Nike program right away. it took years to shut them all down.
I think it's important to recognize how many people in the United States depended on military spending for work.
That's Northwestern University Associate Professor of History, Michael Allen.
A program like this became not just a cash cow, but a kind of thing that once started was very hard to stop. Experts knew that it wasn't creating security.
Our last Nike missile site didn't close until 1974, and there are hardly any Nike remnants left in the area. They've mostly been razed, filled in, turned into parks, or built over and forgotten. As for the missiles themselves, though, Burhouse says the Army kept the warheads, but the rest of the systems?
They were all boxed up, and we sold these systems to a number of other countries, Taiwan, Japan, Greece, Turkey, Panama.
Okay, that's the history buff, bird's eye view of the Nike missile story in Chicago. Now comes the human story that our question asker, Ian Larkin, wanted to.
I would love to be transported back in time to hear, you know, what the mindset of America was at that point, particularly those people that either worked there or lived in and around those sites.
I remember having nightmares about this as a child.
I grew up in the 50s in Gary, Indiana.
I live in Orland Park, Illinois.
And I grew up in Chicago in the Woodlawn area.
I grew up in Highland Park. My feeling as a small child was that Chicago was the center of the earth and we needed a lot of protection. We needed the Army, we needed the Navy, and we needed Nike missiles.
I have a vivid memory of asking my mother where we were keeping our stockpiles of supplies and where our shelter was going to be in case of a nuclear attack, because we lived in an apartment building.
And I remember the old duck and cover drill.
Tuck our heads between our legs and kiss our butt goodbye.
It was kind of scary driving down Lakeshore Drive and seeing all the little hills and knowing that there were live missiles there.
The majority of the population did not know that they had the nuclear capabilities in their communities. I worked on the Nike sites in Mundelein and in Northfield.
I worked in the Nike program as a soldier. The Ajax was a liquid fuel missile and was not fun to work on. We had some people go to the hospital from a gas that it emitted. You know, it is fairly serious stuff.
I decided I was not going to live in fear. I would just realize that the Cold War was something being thought of by politicians and military people.
There's bullies around, you know, schoolyard bullies, heads of state bullies. You know, if you can make them think twice before going after you, that might save your neck.
Hey, it's Jen here again in studio, and the feature piece you just heard was, of course, just part of the story. I couldn't fit all the interesting tidbits that I came across in researching this into that piece, so I thought I'd bring you a couple extra things that surprised me when I first learned them. The first has to do with the technology of the time and why there were three Nike missile sites based on Chicago's coastline, that is, on Lake Michigan. Here's Mark Burhau, the guy who wrote a book on Nike missile sites, explaining more.
So Lake Michigan presents a problem because of the detection systems. A Soviet bomber group could actually have flown over the pole and across Canada, and then if it was flying down Lake Michigan, because of the range of the radars, it would have had a difficult time picking them up.
This amazing resource that we have, Lake Michigan, was actually a liability. Because the radar systems were so limited at the time, it was basically this blank spot where they couldn't tell if there was an enemy plane until it would have gotten very, very close to Chicago. The other thing that surprised me was from a comment that came in after our story aired. We got this note from someone identifying themselves as Naperville resident.
One angle to the story that was missed was that these sites are often contaminated by chlorinated solvents used in degreasers as part of maintenance of the missile systems. Naperville site is enrolled in the Illinois EPA's Voluntary Site Remediation Program due to the carcinogenic chlorinated solvents and the site's proximity to houses using potable water wells. And it is a park.
So I checked out this claim, and it turns out it's true. The Environmental Protection Agency is looking into bioremediation, basically trying to clean up the site in Naperville where the nuclear missiles were housed, because Apparently, there were a lot of contaminants involved in Nike missile sites that leached into groundwater in the soil and that could be harmful for people. They found that the water in the Naperville site exceeds the EPA level for safe drinking water. So right now they're looking into ways to clean up that site, which is currently a park, a sports field. So it was just kind of fascinating that, A, not only do so many people not know about the Nike missile history, including myself and a lot of our colleagues, when we first got this question in, we had to Google it and make sure that this guy's claim was true. We had no idea. And the other thing was, in thinking about these sites being all but gone, you know, most of them have been razed and business parks have been built over. They've been totally forgotten. That there is still this legacy of them, not only just in our minds, but in the soil itself. And it's going to take a long time for that to go away.
That episode of Curious City was produced by Jennifer Brandel, Sean Ali, and Logan Jaffe. If you're the inquisitive type and want to search out more of WBEZ's coverage of Chicago mysteries, you can subscribe to the Curious City podcast, available now on iTunes. That's all we've got for you today on The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. Simply set your target to the center of the page and deploy your mouse click onto The Spot. If you've got a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, please drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. Special thanks to my friend Josh Ellingson for spending most of last night feeding pinball machines in order to get this sound. Tune in next week for a whole new episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.